WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is pianist Marion McPartland, one of the few women instrumentalists who has made it in the very male world of jazz. Her following has grown over the past few years as a result of her Peabody Award-winning National Public Radio series, Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz. If there is such a thing as the jazz life, McPartland's background was not the perfect preparation for it. She grew up in England, in a proper upper-middle-class home, where classical music was appreciated while jazz was heartily disapproved of. She moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. For the first few years of their 20-year marriage, she played Dixieland standards with her husband, but since the early 50s, she's led her own small groups, playing more modern music. Over the years, McPartland has written profiles of fellow musicians. They've been published in jazz magazines, and now these pieces are collected in her new book, All in Good Time, which is published by the Oxford University Press. She also has a new album of music by Billy Strayhorn on the Concord record label. We're going to hear an excerpt of that album in a couple of minutes. Marion McPartland, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Terry. It's nice to be here.
Before we talk about your life, I feel like we should play a duet together, like on your show, but no.
Yeah, why not? We've got a piano. Here, let's try four hands.
Before we talk about your life, I'd like to play an excerpt of your new album of music by Billy Strayhorn. And Strayhorn was Duke Ellington's closest collaborator. He wrote Lush Life and Take the A-Train, Daydream. When you were playing at the Hickory House on 52nd Street in New York, he used to come and hear you sometimes, right?
Yes, he did, often.
Would he comment on your interpretations of his pieces?
It's funny, so many people ask me that. It seems like it would be a natural thing to do, but Billy was such a sweet man and such a charitable, kind soul. You couldn't imagine him ever saying, well, that was nice, but you should do this. And so he always just listened and smiled and would say, oh, that was very lovely, or I enjoyed that, or you played it beautifully. He never, ever offered any kind of criticism at all.
Let's hear an excerpt of a beautiful interpretation that you do of Strayhorn's Daydream, and this is from the new album. Marion McPartland plays the music of Billy Strayhorn. Pianist Marion McPartland from her new album of the music of Billy Strayhorn. It's really a very beautiful recording.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. So many of your listeners on radio have heard you talk with other musicians about their lives. I want to hear some about yours. I know you came from a pretty proper family in England. Your mother played classical music and I think wished that you played classical music too. They didn't like the idea of you playing jazz. What did it represent to your parents?
I don't think they minded. I don't think they minded what I played. It was just when they got the idea that I was going to do something in music, that they weren't going to see me get what they thought would be a nice job. Like my father always thought it would be nice if I worked in a bank or became a nurse, of all ridiculous things. And they really didn't mind me playing jazz, but when they finally got the word that I was going to be in it, then it became a different thing, music as a profession.
What did they object to about that?
Oh, just the idea of, I think my mother said, what was it? Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll marry a musician and live in an attic. See, that's pretty much what happened. Although we weren't ever in the attic, but we were in some funny little apartments. But that was her idea, that I would meet terrible people and that I would come to no good, you know, that it would represent something depraved.
Did your teachers in music school feel the same way?
When I finally studied the 3 years that I did take lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, I played by ear up until that time. When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something. And he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, "Stop playing that trash!" So I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time. But it really wasn't long after that that I left and took off with a four-piano act. That was my first introduction to not so much the jazz life, but the show business life. And actually, now I'm rather proud of having worked in all those vaudeville theaters, because they're very historical places, those of them that are still standing.
Probably gave you some stage confidence also.
Well, yes, and how to act and talk on a microphone, although doing the piano show helped a lot more.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II, when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak, being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then, actually, after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then, when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people. And, of course, because of Jimmy, working with his group. I certainly have a fine Dixieland repertoire, and we still play together, and we still play all those tunes.
Well, when you started playing, you were playing with your husband's band.
Yes.
And I wonder if it was hard for you to get your own sense of identity as a performer. I think a lot of women who are married to someone who they work with, especially a few decades ago, were considered the wife of, and kind of secondary to, the man who was performing. Did that ever happen?
It's funny. I guess I must have been naturally pushy or something. Plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent. And he was always introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He seemed to be very proud of what I did. In fact, when we moved to New York, it was really through Jimmy that I got started with the trio, because I really didn't want to. He kept saying, you ought to have your own trio and you shouldn't be working in this band. I could feel myself getting out of the Dixieland chord structure and into more modern things. And, of course, I listened to everything that was going on all the time. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio. And once I did start with the trio. Jimmy was very helpful in introducing me to all kinds of people. And I always tell him he created a monster because, you know, once I started, I didn't want to stop. That was it.
Well, some jazz musicians remain sidemen all their lives. They spend their lives playing with other people's bands.
That's true.
Very early on in your career, you became a leader. How did you manage to pull that off?
Well, working with Jimmy is sort of, I mean, working with your own husband, I mean, it in many ways, it was a very comfortable situation. And starting with the trio, I guess what happened was that I got booked in this one place, the Embers, and so since I had been booked as the leader, I was able to hire the people to work with me, and from then on, it always was that way. I was always booked and as the leader, and would hire the best. I always wanted the best sidemen there were available. As a matter of fact, in a way, I'm kind of sorry that I didn't, what I would call, go through the ranks and be a side man or side person with some other groups. But it just didn't work out that way because I went right from working with Jimmy to my own trio. And it was very hard because it was a top club and I felt that I was very green and callow. And it's funny, I couldn't open my mouth. I remember we had my group and Eddie Haywood was opposite me and I couldn't even think what to say to introduce him. I had it written on a piece of paper. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And now I'd like to introduce Eddie Haywood. And, you know, I would do it and I would be shaking. It was so funny. But, you know, I guess you learn by doing, you know.
Jimmy McPartland used to drink a lot.
Yes, he sure did.
Did you ever feel, since you were his wife, when you were playing together on the bandstand, that you had to keep one eye on how much he was drinking?
Oh, Terry, that's a whole other... I mean, if you ever want to do a show on alcoholism and AA, I could talk about that. I mean, Jimmy finally went into AA, and I was probably a terrible person because I was always nagging and worrying about that. It just seems like there's always somebody around, a person who drinks a lot. There's always some sort of well-meaning do-gooder trying to keep them straight, and that was me.
Well, that must have put a real strain on your performing, to on the one hand be playing, and on the other hand trying to keep track of what was happening with your husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many anecdotes I could tell about that. At this point, they seem funny, though at the time they weren't, because, you know, when somebody's drinking, they always have a million friends who want to make sure that they buy them drinks and they get their quota. You know, Jimmy would walk around the bar and tell everybody that his wife couldn't stand to see him drink, and so his friends would say, oh, that's terrible, you know, and they would carry a water glass full of gin into the men's room. And I never could figure out how he got... Although Jimmy wasn't sort of a falling down drunk, he just got very slow and boring, you know. And the worst thing that would happen would be he'd be announcing a tune and it would take him 10 minutes to announce the tune and we'd all be saying, oh, for God's sake, get on with it, you know. No, that's a whole other side of my life, and it seems to have, in retrospect, as I say, a lot of it seems very funny, though at the time it was quite a tragedy, but it's great it worked out because he did stop and he has a very healthy life. He's a very healthy person, and so many of the musicians that he worked with are gone, probably because of that. You know, a lot of people died too young, so not so with the old man. He's in good shape.
Did that have anything to do with your wanting to lead your own trio and getting out of playing with him?
No, I don't think so. Not at that time. I don't think so. I think it was just inside me there was this real, must have been this real determined ambition to get ahead. It must have been there because I notice I've always done things consciously or unconsciously to sort of get ahead. And I'm somebody who, as they say, likes to take care of business, you know,
right.
the phone calls and all the things that are really such an important part of doing a job. You can't be late, and you've got to be well rehearsed and know what you're doing at all times.
My guest is jazz pianist Marian McPartland, who you may know as the host of Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz on national public radio stations around the country. She has two big occasions in her life now, the publication of a new book called All in Good Time, which features her profiles of some of her fellow jazz musicians. That's just published on Oxford University Press. And she has a new album of the music of Billy Strayhorn on Concord Records. We're going to talk some more about her life after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Marian McPartland is my guest. You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career. And I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown. So that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so. They would.
You know what might have been helpful to you, too, being married to a jazz musician? And what I mean by that is that you weren't, quote, available to any man who thinks, well, I think I'll flirt with that dame pianist, you know, because
I'm that's true. That's true.
You know,
and then there's this to it also, Terry, that when I did get out with my own trio, I was really in it for the music. Like, although I think I dressed pretty well, you know, cared about my appearance, there wasn't any idea of, well, I'm going to play and I'm going to be winking at some guy at the bar. I wanted so much for the music to be accepted, and I really wanted to play as well as I could, and that's always been in the forefront, you know, to try to play as well as I could. Although at that time I think I was rather dependent upon the opinion of other people. I mean, I'm not so much that anymore. I've sort of become my own person a little more than I was then.
Well, speaking of the opinion of other people, I was reading a Newsweek review of your work from December 30th of 1957.
Oh, my God!
And it said that you played, quote, a romantic arrangement of On the Alamo. And then a little later, her style turned masculine and aggressive as she swung into From This Moment On. And I love that because I don't think that they would have called it a romantic arrangement if it was a man playing a ballad. And then as it was aggressive, it turned masculine. And you must have run into that a lot.
Yeah, that it's funny because after a while, that did start to annoy me. And I would think every time that you would get a little stronger or more forceful. They didn't say that. They didn't call it strong or forceful. It was either aggressive or masculine. And people would say to me, oh, you play just like a man. Or else they'd say, oh, you play good for a girl. And after a while, in the beginning, I sort of took everything as a compliment. But then I would think, well, why does it have to be aggressive? I don't like that word. It just makes me feel so that I'm sort of hunching my shoulders and punching the piano. You know, why does it have to be aggressive? Why can't it just be with more strength or more a more forceful player? So gradually over the years, I think all that stuff has changed. And I've noticed nobody says that anymore.
Right. Did you feel initially uncomfortable in the jazz life as an upper-middle-class British woman? Were you made to feel uncomfortable by that? Did you try to
you mean to get down and to be one of the boys?
Right, exactly. Right. Well, a lot of people go through this. You know, that they're just a little embarrassed about their proper upbringing, and they try to be more down or more bohemian or whatever.
No, I think I was always myself in that regard. In fact, but people used to kid me either about my accent, but I really was one of the group. I mean, I wasn't somebody that sort of was a snob. I think, I mean, although I came, I feel that my family were snobs. My mother was very careful about, she didn't let me mingle with certain kinds of people. Well, that's why they were so upset about me being in the music business, because they felt that everybody in music had to be weird or a bohemian or strange. You know, some of the strangest people I've ever met have had nothing to do with music. I think musicians, for the most part, are a very normal lot of people, and certainly more fun. And a musician is something really extra special, more different from other people in a good way. I don't know how to explain it.
In your new book, you mentioned that a lot of women singers influenced your playing. And, you know, women singers have always been accepted more than women instrumentalists.
Oh, definitely. That's a whole other breed. Yeah, singers. I don't know why that is. Well, because every band had the girl singer. And, you know, that's a whole other story. I don't even want to get into that. I would hate to have been a girl singer because I feel that you're really fair game then when you're traveling on with a busload of guys. And that must have been awfully hard.
And you had to dress more sexy, too.
Oh, sure.
Low-cut gowns and things like that when you were the, quote, girl singer. You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers, well, early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording, and then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of, in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow, upward
It's amazing,
rise, and every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful, and it's I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I think, well, I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else. And I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more. I should be able to play more. And I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling. I think, well, you should be able to do better. You should be able to play better. You should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
You know, probably
the wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had. And you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
You've, as a musician, had to be on the road a lot during your life. You've been lucky enough to have very long stays at certain clubs, like the Cafe Carlyle in New York and the Hickory House in New York. But I think life on the road is the downfall of a lot of performers, and it's in part how they end up on drugs or alcohol. Was it hard to not give in to temptations like that, especially probably with some of the, not peer pressure exactly, but when you're hanging out with people and everybody's going drinking after the set, you know?
Oh, I had my share of drinks, but I always had that feeling about, like, years ago when we used to be hanging out in pubs in England, it was always, you know, you're supposed to be able to drink and hold it. You're not supposed to get drunk. You know, it's sort of undignified and terrible, undignified thing to do. So I could never, ever see myself getting out of control. I mean, I used to like to have drinks at the Hickory House. In fact, I used to like to pour a straight shot when nobody was looking. I thought I was really getting back at the owner. I would get one of the bottles. You know, we were surrounded by bottles on the bandstand, and when nobody was looking, I would pour myself a shot and drink it, you know, and sort of one up for me. But as far as pot or any of the other things, I wouldn't do that to myself. I mean, I did smoke a little pot, but just once or twice. But it never affected me in a good way. And a bass player once said to me, "Oh, but Marion, you really have to learn how to handle that. You have to get used to being able to handle it." I said, "Well, if I have to do that, then I don't want to do it." And I've never done anything that would get in the way of playing, although I can see how that would be a hang-up for some people, because I think one has that feeling of wanting to be on top and be the best you can possibly be every night, and that if you take something that's going to help you be that way, temptation is to be wanting to do that every night.
You know, our listeners who are familiar with your Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz series will, I'm sure, want to know if you have a new series, a new round of programs in the works.
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we're going to start taping in October. And I'm looking forward to having Claude Bowling on the show. In fact, I think this will give me a chance to maybe try to learn one of his pieces. That he has some wonderful stuff written out, but now I'll be interested to see what he does improvising. Then I'm also going to have Harold Mayburn. He said he'll do the show. Hilton Ruiz. And if I can get the date together, T. Carson, who now plays in the Basie Band.
Well, I wish you the best with the new series, and I thank you very much.
Are we done?
For being with us. Yeah, the time just flew by. Thank you so much for being here, Marion McPartland.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
My guest has been jazz pianist Marion McPartland. If you'd like to hear more of her playing, there's her radio series on many NPR stations around the country, and she has a new album called Marion McPartland Plays the Music of Billy Strayhorn on Concord Records. She also has a new book called All in Good Time, and it features profiles she's written over the years of many of her fellow musicians. All in Good Time is published by the Oxford University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.